I've been developing a kind of unit of presentations in these times that we're here with you. The central idea is that the Christian world is in process of radical change at the moment. And the kind of change which is occurring can be characterized as a shift from a sort of social political action orientation to something that appears to be more kind of contemplative and meditative and inner directed and spiritual. And what I'm really very much concerned about is that both of these tendencies sort of be retained at the same time, so that the one doesn't cancel out the other. And that's so, this is the third time that I've talked on this subject. On the first night, I attempted to chronicle or to kind of trace the changes that have occurred in religious awareness, I would call it, or Christian consciousness over the past decade and a half. Then last night, I focused more particularly on the religion that goes on in the monasteries, or the monastic religion as kind of viewed from the inside. And what I wanted to do tonight is to talk about Thomas Merton, who was until his death in 1968 a Trappist monk, and who is probably more responsible than any other individual for this change that is occurring in Christian awareness. And then I have two more times, if all goes well, I mean, if the interest keeps up and enthusiasm and so forth. And the next one is tomorrow morning at 11, and the final one is Saturday morning at 11. There won't be any more evening sessions. Something else is planned for tomorrow night. And what I wanted to do tomorrow is to talk about the new interest in mysticism, and then have some kind of summary on Saturday, so that the five will sort of hang together, the five presentations. Now, and so for tonight, I've divided. I went through the seminary, and I know about sermons that have three parts. I've got a three-part outline here, which is very, very straightforward. The second part is called anecdotes, but ordinarily that comes first. But I put that second here because the first part is a little heavy, and I think we need the anecdotes after the first part. First part is on the life of Thomas Merton. Second, just some stories about Thomas Merton, and then third part on the thought of Thomas Merton. And I'll take these three parts in order, and I think you'll be able to tell when I'm moving from part one to part two to part three. I want to read something though from Thomas Merton before I say anything about his life. I'm really not quite advertising, but I didn't bring all of my notes and books and things along. And so for quotations from Thomas Merton, I really only had two sources. I didn't go through all the libraries here, but there are some good books on Thomas Merton here. In the bookstore over there, there's the autobiography of Thomas Merton called The Seven Story Mountain, which is really, really good. I almost bought that again today so I could have these quotations ready tonight, but I already have three copies of that. And so instead of that, I'm quoting from a book that I wrote, which has two chapters on Thomas Merton. And this comes from an essay of his entitled As Man to Man, where he describes how he understands the role of the monk in contemporary society. And he writes this way, and there's just three brief sentences. I have been summoned to explore a desert area of man's heart in which explanations no longer suffice. It is an arid, rocky, dark land of the soul, sometimes illuminated by strange fires, which men fear, and is peopled by specters, which men studiously avoid, except in their nightmares. And in this area, I have learned that one cannot truly know hope unless he has found out how like despair hope is. Now, I start with that quotation where Merton talks about the role of his understanding of the role of the monk in terms of the exploration of the human heart. I start with that because he refers to the heart as a desert. And We were on that theme the other night, or last night, and I think emphasized how strong the image of the desert is in monastic religion. Monasteries or monastic religion depends upon the desert imagery, and the desert imagery is understood both externally or exteriorly, that the world is a desert, and interiorly, that the human heart is a desert. And in this quotation, which is very typical of the attitude that Merton shows throughout his writings, he refers to the human heart as being a desert area, which he has been asked, he feels called upon, it's his vocation, to explore. Now, when he talks about the exploration of it, he talks about how strange the things are that go on there. He refers here to the strange fires which men fear, to the specters which we studiously avoid, except in our nightmares. And then also about how close hope and despair are to each other. When one learns the sort of the rhythms, the pulsations, the cadences of the human heart. And I think that's probably the place to begin, because I'm anticipating criticisms of monasticism here, and the criticisms are all right. I don't want to defend that fully, but there are some kind of sort of first impression criticisms that can be met with rather effectively in these terms. And one of those is that those men are wasting their lives. They go off and they don't do all the things that all of us more normal people have to do, contend with, like raising families and making things ends meet, and doing all the things with our homes and in society and culture that is usually required of human beings. What I've come to learn is that monastic religion is not that much of a luxury. I mean, it's not that easy, and in fact, it's not that pleasant. It's made boring deliberately. If it were attractive, they say, well, then people would be called to it for the wrong reasons. The meals are boring, for example. They don't allow card playing or stamp collecting or watching television or having any of these kind of diversions to kind of mediate boredom. But boredom is just right out there in the open. People can be bored. There isn't just a lot of activity planned for them, but they have to come to terms with themselves. And this is what you find in writing after writing, that when the individual comes to terms with the human heart, this is what he finds. We had a little bit this morning in the meditation after breakfast on original sin and individuation. And that's very much in keeping with this quotation from Merton, that when one comes to terms with himself or herself, one discovers how kind of nightmarish the human heart really is. And it's for that reason that we, according to these people, try to avoid that sort of self-consciousness. Well, I don't want to get into the thought here until I've said something about his life. He was an American. I can't remember when he was born. I think it's about 1915, but I don't have my notes on that. And unfortunately, I'm so dependent upon all notes and so forth for dates and things that I'm not quite sure when he was born. His father was artistic by nature. He really didn't know quite where he belonged. Thomas Merton was born in America, but shortly after his birth, he moved to Europe, and he lived for a number of years, during his formative years, in France, where he went to school, and also in England. And his the education prior to the college years, just immediately prior, 6 or 8 years prior to that, all of that occurred in England in boarding schools, private schools. He was not with his parents very much. His mother died when Thomas was very young, and he was raised in part by his grandparents. He felt very close to his grandfather. There are a lot of, if you can go into the family history here, and I don't think anyone's done it yet, but you can make get some kind of insight regarding what kind of person he is because of his relationship with his parents. And it also meant that he was cosmopolitan almost by birth or by nature. He lived in very many places. He was at home in France and England and also in America. Well, during his college time, he came to Columbia University in New York City and was pursuing a degree in English literature. very much interested in William Blake. That's also very significant because there's been a great interest in Blake recently, but this is back prior to World War II when Thomas Merton was on to William Blake. And while he was at Columbia, he came under the influence of a professor of English, Mark Van Doren, who guided his intellectual interests, but more importantly than that, helped him find out who he was. And it's been said of Mark Van Doren, not only by Thomas Merton, but by very many of Mark Van Doren's students, that students come to know who they are when they take courses from him. And that's a great tribute to, that's the best that any teacher can ask for. It isn't that he simply imparts content or knowledge to people, but students came to find out who they were while under his influence. He writes about this in The Seven Story Mountain, Thomas Merton does. He likes to kind of portray himself as somewhat of a worldly man. I don't think he was really all that worldly. He liked to drink beer, and he went to the some of the night spots in New York City, and he had girlfriends, and he brags about that a little bit later on, I think to show that he's a sort of regular sort of person, that he wasn't kind of odd and during those years, but he did enjoy life very much. He enjoyed New York culture. But all the way through this, and you can pick up these strains even very early in his autobiography, there is a sense of a really unrest or an unwillingness to accept New York City without raising critical questions about it. And it's as though New York City becomes the symbol of capitalism, particularly American capitalism, and he's as much opposed to capitalism as he is to communism. He's very friendly with Marxism, and that, if I say that in some circles, that at that point interest in Thomas Merton is just kind of cut off. But he thought that capitalism was deceptive because it made people think that they had needs which they really didn't have. That is, you had to create the need for certain products in order to sell those products, and you had to persuade people that those products were necessary to their well-being when those products really weren't necessary to well-being, not in any elemental sense. They might become necessary to a kind of, an acquisitive society, or it may be possible for you to persuade yourself that such things are necessary. But he thought the whole thing was rather phony, and he writes about that in writing about New York City as a symbol for the whole thing. Let's see if I can find that quickly. Here we are. This is from The Seven Story Mountain. He says it is true that the materialistic culture that has evolved under the tender mercies of capitalism has produced what seems to be the ultimate limit of worldliness. And nowhere, except perhaps in the society of pagan Rome, has there ever been such a flowering of cheap, petty and disgusting lusts and vanities as in the world of capitalism, where there is no evil that is not fostered and encouraged for the sake of making money. We live in a society whose whole policy is to excite every nerve in the human body and keep it at the highest pitch of artificial tension, to strain every human desire to the limit, and to create as many new desires and synthetic passions as possible in order to cater to these desires and passions with the products of our factories, our printing presses, our movie studios, and all the rest. That there's only one point there, and it's very clear, I think. It would be that, to paraphrase a little bit, desire is the root of all evil, and desires are fabricated or constructed. They're not elemental or human desires that society caters to, but they're desires that we have acquired. And the old thing of looking around and seeing that somebody has a new car or a television set, or the way we talked about it last week at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, somebody gets a trailer, and then the next thing is you have to have a boat put on top of the trailer and motorcycle behind, and if you can see that thing happening everywhere. Well, how many of those things are really necessary to well-being? They become necessary to well-being because we become dependent upon those things, and I think his point is that the world becomes created out of things of that kind. And it's an artificial world, but we don't know how artificial it is, until we can get away from it, and get a clear alternative to it, so we have a perspective on it which teaches us its deceptiveness and its kind of illusory character. Now, I mentioned that he was a cosmopolitan, interested in English literature, and also somewhat of a social activist. He was that from the very beginning, as soon as he became kind of intellectually aware. He was not a religious person, not even during college time. And his kind of religious odyssey, which he traces in the Seven Story Mountain, is a rather characteristic one, but it's striking at the same time. One day, it's as though he wakes up. He wakes up to the fact that he has become religious, that his nature is, that he has a kind of religious sensitivity about him, and that he can't deny it. It's a little bit like C.S. Lewis's Surprised by Joy. It's not that he set out to do this, but one day there he was. He had to admit to himself that the way he saw things was through a kind of religious perspective. Then he goes on, and he discovers in the next stage that he's Catholic, Catholic Christian. I'd say Catholic rather than Roman Catholic, but that's a kind of a fine distinction. But it's Catholic because he's cosmopolitan, because he couldn't take a Nordic religion, not with his identification with France and all that his father meant to him, or New York City. And it wasn't as though he took Presbyterianism and Methodism and Lutheranism and all these other denominations and he picked out one because he thought that was the most suitable for him. It's more that he discovered that his psyche, his awareness, was being characterized or formed by a kind of Catholic Christian disposition, and he simply acknowledged that's the way it was for him. He'd been going to masses once in a while, but not very regularly. And then on another day, it's as though he wakes up and he discovers that he won't be able to deny becoming a priest. He feels that there is some kind of call, a very clear call to the priesthood. And then the next thing to do is to find out what he ought to do about that. Well, it's at that point that he starts moving around. He looks at a number of religious orders because he is sure that he wants to become a member of an order and not a priest outside of an order. He's very much attracted to the Franciscan order, but he discovers after some testing of it that it's not austere enough for him. He likes St. Francis of Assisi, but the Franciscans are a little bit too much in the world and out of the world and kind of back and forth. That's also the kind of standard criticism of the Benedictines in monastic life, that they're so much like the rest of us that they don't provide a kind of radical alternative to the standard way of being. Well, he ends up being he chooses to be a Trappist, which is a rather austere form of monastic life. But this all happens during the early part of the Second World War. He's also wrestling. I mean, the biggest wrestling match at that point is not with what order he should enter, but what he ought to do about the war, nonviolence, pacifism. All of these things are very clear possibilities for him. At the same time, he feels some obligation, great obligation, and he goes down and takes his physical to be drafted, and he is a possibility that had never occurred to him occurs, that he is not allowed to be drafted in the army for physical reasons. And if you know the reason for that, that's always one way to kind of wake up an audience and group. He doesn't have enough teeth. They count his teeth, and too many were missing. He passed on all other grounds, but not enough teeth. So he didn't go into the army, and he went out to near Louisville, Kentucky, to Gethsemane Monastery, where Lois and I, our children, visited in December, and spent some time there. And he writes a couple of weeks, or maybe a little more. He writes about that with great joy in the Seven Story Mountain. He goes back to New York City, and then he knows that Gethsemane Monastery near Louisville, Kentucky, is the place for him, and eventually moves there, and was there 17 years before he left. Well, he got out on a few occasions, but didn't leave for any extended period of time until 1968, when he, does that check out right? That's about right, I guess. Maybe I'm a little bit off there on the 17 years. He might have been, I know he was not, he didn't leave the place for a 17-year period, but he went off to Bangkok to Thailand to a conference. And he went there because he wanted to learn from the Asian monks something about Asian forms of spirituality. And on one day when he was addressing a group of monks and nuns on Marxism and monasticism, he gave this lecture in the morning, and in the final line of this lecture he said, "I will disappear." And he did. And that's actually not quite the way the story goes. If you see the thing on the tape, the final line is, he says, "Well, I've come to the end of what I had to say. I understand that there will be some questions and answers, and the question and answer period this evening after supper. So for now, I will disappear, and you can all go off and have a Coke or something." But the way they portray this in the Asian Journal, which is the writing published after his death in 68, "So I will disappear" was the last line of the last lecture that he gave. He went off and had lunch, took a shower after lunch, was walking back with some people from the shower back to his room in a kind of motel set up there. And there was a short in the light, or I've seen this both ways, light or fan that he turned on, and he was electrocuted. And they found him a couple of hours later with these scars across his body. And the man who found him, if he hadn't had shoes on, he would have been killed also, because he picked up the thing and then had, of course, shut off the electricity. Now, there isn't very much you can say about his life which is very exciting, because those are pretty much the events. I mean, here's a man who lived most of his time in a sort of cell in a monastery near Louisville, Kentucky. Did an awful lot of writing. Probably didn't do much writing. He was advised by his abbot to write. His vocation was to write. And it's sort of forced writing in a way. He repeats himself a tremendous amount. But there's a kind of lore that has developed up around about him because of the recognition that this was a holy man, I think. And this the death that he died, dying like that by burning, is and following this speech in which he said, "And so I will disappear," has made many people take a really close look at the last line of his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, which ends up with a reference to being in the company of Christ's burnt men. That seemed to be the goal, being in the company of Christ's burnt men. And he dies, you know, by this kind of accidental electrocution by burning, which some people would say, well, you know, he kind of prophesied his own death, but I don't know how you can ever check that out. We talked to his best friend, this brother Patrick Hart, who said that was just, they called him Brother Louis in the monastery. That was just like Brother Louis. He didn't understand electricity. He wouldn't have known 110 volts from 220. And he said there's none of this mystical thing of being able to tell by what form you're going to die. But it still is rather interesting that he would write in that way. Now, I'm ready for part two of this, and I'm not going to say very much more about his life. But I always like to get these kind of human interest stories, and I didn't ever meet Thomas Merton myself, but I've talked to Houston Smith, who now teaches at Syracuse University, who has written one of the most popular textbooks in religion in colleges and universities. And Houston Smith spent, he was with Thomas Merton on that last journey that Merton made to Asia, and rode with him on the plane over. So I talked to Houston Smith about him and asked him just what was he like. And there are a couple of things that are worth passing on. Houston said that that when he first met Thomas Merton, he didn't know quite how to get conversation going. So he asked him what it was like being a monk. And Merton replied, he said, "It's very nice. It's very nice." Now, Houston didn't know what to say then, because he didn't expect that. So he asked him how he spent his day. And then and Thomas Merton gave him a little rundown of how he spent the day. He said he got up every morning at 4:30, and he had the early worship service. And then he went to the Hermitage, and he fixed himself a breakfast and drank 8 cups of coffee. And while he was doing all this, he said, the phrase was, singing in tongues all the while. You know, fixing breakfast, cooking coffee, singing in tongues all the while, which Houston Smith thought meant maybe for an hour or so, this man was kind of singing to himself in this hermitage. And that's not an awful lot, you know, to say about a man, but it does say something about the sort of person he was. The other the little bit of information we have on him is what comes from his biographer, Brother Patrick Hartz, at the monastery in Louisville. And we talked to him because there was there's a lot of speculation that Merton really didn't like the monastery, that he was trying, he wanted to go to Alaska or someplace else, more remote from society than even the monastery in Kentucky. And we found out from him that his biggest difficulty was that he couldn't say no to anybody, that people would break through the walls of the monastery and come up to the hermitage and ask him questions and even ask for his autograph, and he was never unkind, even though they weren't allowed to do that. There are signs up everywhere saying that this is cloistered and they're forbidden to travel that area, but that happened all day long, and he would answer these requests, and that may be why he wanted to go to Alaska. Well, I'm going to say something now about why I think he's important. I've touched on the first theme already, and that's the theme that monasticism for him was not understood to be withdrawal or retreat from the world, but it was a way to deal with the problem of alienation. And alienation is the major human problem. That is, we are, as he saw it, we are alienated from our roots, from what is primary, from the way we ought to be. We don't know who we are. We don't know what we are to be. So we get by with kind of substitute identities. The world, if we really immerse ourselves in the world as it is, without being critical about it, we can't be satisfied. Our nature is not satisfied. We're given kind of surrogate happiness, surrogate satisfaction, artificial satisfaction. And that whole the reference I made earlier to capitalism and its ills is a case in point. There are manufactured needs and are met by manufactured things, and that just leads to deception everywhere. People aren't true to each other. All this business about being wearing masks and playing roles and wearing hats and all of that's too much the way the world is. And so for him, monasticism became a form of social protest by offering an alternative way of being. It wasn't that they were going to go into the monasteries to protest, to write letters to congressmen and all that, to protest the way things are the way things are. Rather, the monastery becomes another way of being. It offers an alternative, what we could say, lifestyle to people who are looking for that, who sense the deceptiveness of social and cultural life. Now that's very different from an understanding of monasticism as a place to which people go to save their own souls. He didn't have that in mind, really. I mean, it may be assisted or aided by monastic life, but that was not the intention. First intention was, this is effective social protest. That is, by forming, creating, developing, cultivating an alternative way of life to the kind of standard, accepted way of life of the institutions, the establishment, all the things that became sort of part of the cry of the late 60s and early 70s through the counterculture. So that's, I suppose when the history books are written about Thomas Merton, the first thing they'll say is that he, because of this attitude toward monasticism, his greatest contribution was in the area of monastic renewal, renewing the monasteries from within, bringing new life to them, new verve, new character, giving the people within them a new attitude about what it was, about what they were doing, and not so much interpreting monastic life to people outside, although he did do a tremendous amount in that regard as well. The second area in which his thought, I think, is significant has to do with his attitude toward religions other than the Christian religion. And that's the first time that I've said anything about that in these three evenings. But that's really a very important issue. Now, the indication we have of this is that Merton wanted to go to Asia to learn from, well, primarily Buddhist monks, the techniques of spiritual awareness, meditation, contemplation, asceticism. Because, he said, and he said this to Christian monks and nuns, he said, they know so much more about this than we do. I've heard that so many times in monasteries, that Pascal Phillips, for example, talked to somebody about Pascal Phillips down in Lafayette, Oregon. he says the same thing. He says that we've been practicing this for all these years, but we really don't know as much about it as the Asian monks do, who are of the non-Christian religion, but who have cultivated the same sort of practices. Now, if you develop that attitude into a kind of a thesis, what Merton is saying, I think, is really important. He's not the only person to say this. Much of what he said on this subject, he learned from two people, as far as I can tell, R.C. Zahner, who was the Spalding professor of history of religion at Oxford until he died about a year and a half ago, and probably more significantly, Teilhard de Chardin, or some people call him Teilhard de Chardin, or in any of those ways. And probably more significantly, Teilhard de Chardin, or some people call him Teilhard de Chardin, or in any of those ways. The name is the same. It's like what Chesterton said about, I'm getting off track here a little bit. Chesterton said about the question, who wrote the five books of Moses? He said, after studying that for a long time, he has come to the conclusion that it wasn't Moses who wrote those books, but somebody whose name was Moses. Well, it turns out to be the same person either way. And Teilhard is very important to Merton, and the attitude that he develops based on the insights of these two theorists is that the Christian religion has a responsibility as well as a capacity to complement or perfect the other religious traditions. Now, there's a Catholic, a definite Thomistic principle here, but you can find the same thing in the writings of Nathan Sederblom, because I want to say that so that it's not kind of parochially Catholic to say this. It's there are also Lutheran theorists who work this way, and there are also some Reformed theorists who go that way, who follow the same principle. The principle is that grace perfects nature without destroying it. Grace perfects nature without destroying it. And so translated into these terms, the Christian religion can perfect the other religious traditions, but without nullifying them. They don't have to be canceled. And from that point of view, a religion like Buddhism would not be a false religion, but it would be an incomplete religion, or a religion that is not fully developed. And according to this point of view, the Christian religion can help bring the Buddhist religion beyond its kind of present state. That is, the Christian religion can be instrumental in making the Buddhist religion, more mature, or more complete, or fuller, or richer. And the Christian religion, Christianity, can have that relationship to all religions, in principle. I mean, all religious traditions can be perfected, or brought up, or made more, or complemented, or supplemented, or all of those words, embellished, augmented. Because of their contact with Christianity. Now that's a different attitude from a somewhat typical Protestant kind of mission theory approach, where it's only the Christian religion that counts. And it's not only the Christian religion that counts, it's only Christ that counts. I'm thinking here of Hendrik Kramer, who was the student of Karl Barth, who was fashioned a lot of Protestant mission theory, even the kind that I was trained in at Augustana Seminary back in the late 50s, where the attitude is that it's only Christ and only within the context of Christianity, and all these other religions are false religions, or they just, they can't be confirmed at all. Now, Merton would say something different from that. He wouldn't say that those religions are true, but they do have true insights, and he wouldn't even say that Christianity is a true religion as a religion, but it has true insights, but it has, there are a lot of things within Christianity which are still in process of development, which haven't come all the way yet. So you can't say that the religion itself as a religion is true in totality, but because that's not the nature of the religion. Rather, it's with respect to these other religions, Christianity can help bring them to the truth or beyond themselves. And I suppose I would guess if I polled this, and most of you would probably agree with that attitude toward the, maybe not, but I don't know, the relationship between Christianity and non-Christian religions. But then there's a hooker. He goes beyond this, and he wants the same influence to go the other way. That is, that the other religions can help Christianity to become more what it was meant to be. So Christianity then does not develop in isolation, and it's not perfect yet. It's still in process of development and formation. And some of the instruments of its perfection or development or maturation are other religions. So you take the thesis that grace perfects nature without destroying it, and you can say that the Christian religion perfects the other religious traditions without destroying them, but then you can add, but the other religious traditions can help expand, enlarge, illumine, amplify, augment Christianity without destroying it. Now that I think probably it's more for that reason than for his attachment to monasticism that Merton has become interesting to, well, modern-day scholars, even contemporary students, because I'm really convinced that we're already in a day where if you're a student of this subject, and many of you are, I know, it's very, very, very true to say what Max Müller said, that he who knows only one religion knows none. He who knows only one knows none. The context now for studying religion is this broad kind of world religions or comparative religions or cross-cultural religious base. And that's already true in the field of religious studies. I mean, I can vouch for that. I know that as a fact. And it's becoming more and more true in the study of theology. The world religions will become, or is becoming, the kind of normative context for theological studies. And this would mean that all of our, you know, our future ministers, even present ministers, pastors, will be trained that way. That is, it won't be enough for them to know just Christianity, the history of the church, but they'll have to, more and more, will have to know the history of the other religious traditions. And as I see it, that's all to the good. But that's going to make a very, very different situation now from the situation that we've known up until the present time. I just kind of reiterate that. I think that Merton's journey to Asia was rather symbolic. He went there to learn. He didn't go there to tell. He didn't go there as a missionary. He went there to find out from the monks what they were doing, because he thought that they were further ahead in these areas than we Christians are, and we needed to learn from them. He also believed very fully that we had much that we could teach them and share with them. But it's clear in his writings, it just as clear as it was that he wanted to be nonviolent and pacifist during the time of the Second World War, that his understanding of the relationship between religious traditions was meant to be non-combative, non-competitive. They were not competitors to the truth. They're not like armies, you know, or competing schools or ideologies which cancel each other out, but they are potential contributors to a much richer religious context than the world has ever known before. And he very much welcomed this the new possibilities which the relationship between religion, Christian religion and non-Christian religions was about to make possible. And I think he's a sort of a kind of forerunner of discussions that are occurring at the present time. And I'd like to say that this is the most exciting time in religious studies circles, or even theological in theological circles, because that subject has become so interesting and so important. And that old Swedish Archbishop of Uppsala, Nathan Söderblom, was one of the first to get into the subject. So Lutherans have been into the thing from the very beginning. It'd be a good subject even if Lutherans weren't in it, but it's very, very clear that Lutherans are playing a really leading role in kind of sorting out all of that. Final thing, and I'll just say this very, very, very briefly. He's also important because of the rigor which he applied to an analysis of the interior life. He was, I'd say no dummy, but that's not quite the way to talk about it. He was methodical as could be. He was, and some say that was his problem. The problem that he was so analytical that he was almost sort of kept from being mystical because he was an analyst. But he did, as I quoted him in saying, he did explore the human heart more and more and more, and reports on provides a number of reports on his findings. I want to read one. I think I'll just close with this. I want to read another kind of summary statement regarding what he understood his role to be. And he refers to himself as a contemplative. He says the contemplative is not the one who has fiery visions of the cherubim carrying God on their imagined chariot, but rather the one who has risked his mind in the desert. There's that desert thing again. The one who has risked his mind in the desert beyond language and beyond ideas, where God is encountered in the nakedness of pure trust. The message of hope the contemplative offers is not that you need to find your way through the jungle of language and problems, but that whether you understand or not, God loves you, lives in you, dwells within you. The contemplative has nothing to tell you except to reassure you and to say that if you dare to penetrate your own silence and risk sharing that solitude with the lonely other who seeks God through you and with you, then you will truly recover the light and the capacity to understand what is beyond words, because it is too close to be explained. There's a colon in this thing, and this is the final line following the colon. It is the intimate union in the depths of your own heart of God's spirit and your own secret inmost self, so that you and he are in truth one spirit. Now, I'll close with that because I think that's the message. If he were preaching to us, that's what he would talk about. This other thing about social protest and new attitude toward the religions of the world, sort of my ways of analyzing what he was up to. But what he lived and died for was that insight that the human being, as we heard it this morning following breakfast, the human being is made in the image of God. And whether that's, no matter how we understand the injury there, and we all understand that there was an injury, that can be recovered and reformed. Well, if we had the time, and see, if I had 10 weeks on this, as I usually do when I'm teaching, and then the thing we do next is to talk about how he opens up the psychic life, and he discovers that there's more than one self within the self, not just a single self, but several selves. Then you can go on from there to talk about Carl G. Jung and his work on archetypal consciousness and about all the selves that come to play in the makeup of the human psyche. And I would go on from there to talk about James Hillman, who's done some kind of innovative work on Carl G. Jung's psychology. But that's really more than we can do tonight. And I think I've, again, talked longer than I should have. Does anyone here want to say anything? I think I can take it if the reaction is negative.
I was wondering about how optimistic they were about blending the different religions. Christianity and Judaism haven't made much progress in the last 2,000 years.
No, and that's right. There's another problem there. But when they, I think it's a tendency to talk about the Judeo-Christian tradition, or no? Let me say it more carefully. The religions of the East and the religions of the West, Asian religions and Western religions. That's usually the way it's divided in curricula, you know, in coursework in religious studies around the country. And then you have Judaism, Christianity, and Islam on the side of the West, and you have all Hinduism, Buddhism, Shinto, all the others, all the Asian religions on the other side. And I gave some talks on that subject to the ALC Pastors Conference last fall in down in Palm Desert. Five talks on that, and in the final one, it's kind of a good way to answer, to respond to your point. I said that this won't be like the ecumenical movement. It won't be that you'll have these. I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think you'll have representatives of Buddhism and Christianity and Hinduism and all the other religions who will kind of sit down and iron out their differences so they can worship together. It's much. The relationship is much more complicated than that. Much more complex than that. There's a tremendous kind of. There'll be sharing and borrowing of ideas and insights. Of course, that's already happening. And it's going to be that subtle kind of thing and non-programmed kind of exchanges. For example, the meditation exercises the clear example of that is the prayer of centering that is practiced in many Christian churches, which probably has an Asian point of origin. Even transcendental meditation. Now, you can find examples of that in the West, but the clearer examples are in the East. I guess I want to say one other thing about that, because it has to do with, I think, what has been happening in the study of religion in this country over the past 10 years. And I think I can make this interesting, even though it has to do with the study. There are very many college students who couldn't tolerate a course in the Christian religion, let's say 10 years ago, because the way these courses were presented, and it was because the way we were all trained who taught these courses were presented as though they were history of idea courses. They were courses in belief, in doctrine, theology. When we went through the Middle Ages, we hit all the big theologians, Augustine, Anselm, Abelard, Aquinas, Luther, Calvin, all of them, depending on how many weeks you had to do that. And the impression was given that Christianity is heady. It's something you think about. And we also gave the impression that it was so wonderful, the Christian religion was so wonderful that you could never really understand it. The thoughts would always go beyond your capacity to think them through. Well, that was kind of a false impression because it was a one-sided impression that was given. And I'm looking back now, I can see what I think happened. There was this great interest in the religions of Asia that occurred following that, even in opposition to an interest in the Western religions, or Christianity in particular, because the Asian religions came on as something very different from that. They were experiential religions. You could understand the insights of Buddhism rather quickly. They had to do with spirituality, with interiority. You could feel it. You didn't have to memorize syllogisms and work your way through thought patterns, but it was something that led to the kind of transformation of the person, or even to rather maybe not instant, but early self-knowledge. It was self-knowledge that you could really feel. I'm being autobiographical here because I'm talking about my own kind of exposure to Zen Buddhism. It was amazing. It was like the first time I really got hold of Platonism. It just seemed like everything changes from that point forward because of it. You could appropriate it so nicely, or so effectively, and the results were there. Well, now what has happened in the next stage is that these same students and the same people who have been exposed to Asian religions are coming back now, not because they're disappointed, really, but coming back to the Christian religion and are asking Asian questions about the Christian religion. So what we've had to do when we're teaching these courses is to scrap all that heady theology, or bracket it for the time being, and look to the spiritual traditions which have been there, the mystical traditions in the Middle Ages, and then we discover that there's very much the same thing in the West that we found in the East. You can read Buddhist and Hindu mystics alongside Tauler or Meister Eckhart or St. John of the Cross or Teresa of Avila. And I would say that the Western mystics are much richer in their portrayals because they are Christian. But it's at that point that you begin to make the distinction between the religions. there's a certain quality of the mystical, the mystical portrayal, which you know, kind of, I mean, indicates that this is Christian mysticism over against any other kind. I don't want to have these things competing with each other yet. I think there's a time when they have to, maybe one has to choose between one or the other. But for the time being, they can illumine each other. And I think that's the sort of exchange that will occur. Someone will be exposed to Asia and will say, well, why don't we do that here? Well, is there any reason why we can't do that? And there's no reason why you can't do that. No reason why you can't sit on the floor in a kind of a lotus position. It makes perfect sense to keep your body fit, to do the breathing exercises. And you wouldn't want to say just because that's Asian, you know, and it's not, and we don't know if it has Christian sources, we're going to leave that alone. No, I don't think it's that way at all. And the same thing is happening the other way. And this is why I'm so interested in the monasteries. The conferences, those kinds of exchanges are occurring in monastic circles. I refer to a big conference that occurred in Mount Xavier, a monastery near Elmira, New York, where Buddhists, Hindus, and Christians, and some rabbis got together to talk about, well, there's going to be another one in Calgary on the 24th of September, to talk about what these religions really do have in common in those kind of spiritual interior terms. That's not the whole story, but it's...
Carl Matson of your own seminary and Martin Heineken of Mount Airy says the Christian faith is the death of all religion. How would you distinguish between their use of the term religion and your use of it?
Gee, that's the kind of question you get during a doctoral exam. I don't know. Are they referring to the traditions, to religions, or I bet you have a better insight into that.
Religion too. They were referring specifically to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just a Bible. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And mm-hmm. The others haven't the way. And yet the idea, the exclusiveness of Christianity is what mm-hmm. we find in that kind of...
Yeah, I don't suppose... I'm not sure I can answer that, but I want to think about that some, because I can't put the quotations in context very quickly. I don't think I would ever want to say that the goal of religion is religion. I think religion brings persons beyond religion. Well, I'll say it clearly. I think religion pertains to life. Right? Life is the real context, and religion refers to life, and not just individual life, but corporate life and our life with God and our eternal life and. All forms of life. So the goal would not be to make people religious, but religion has something of a kind of instrumental function to it, and particularly in Christianity, that the goal is to not make people members of the Christian religion, but bring to them a point where they know the way, the truth, and the life. Now, I don't know if that's what he had in mind in talking about. In other words, there's a kind of transcendence of religion. But that's also, that's a truth that is enunciated in the other religious traditions. It wouldn't be enough to be a Buddhist, but self-knowledge is what is there, and Buddhism is of some assistance in that. Yes.
I think that's what's so joyous about your conclusion is that I had somehow in my popular reading picked up the feeling that Merton was deserting us. He was going over to the enemy, and this puts a completely new complexion on it, that he was trying to learn from someone else to bring back and enrich his own tradition.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of what an Oriental question would be asked to Christianity?
An Oriental question?
Well, you said an Eastern question. You said that one of the purposes was to, in studying monastic, non-Christian monastic orders in, say, Tibet, mm-hmm. that one could immerse himself in the study of, say, Buddhism and then bring back to Christianity Oriental questions or Eastern questions. What would be an example of an Eastern question?
Well, I don't know if it'd be a question. I may have said that. I think it might be an insight. I guess I would follow the same kind of pattern that I've worked through just a few minutes ago. I think there's a I'll do better than that. I think that Buddhism has insight into desire, into the world of desire, which is very unique and profound. Saying that the desire is the root of all unhappiness. That's easy to say, but if you think about the ramifications of that, if you could ever get to the point where you didn't have to ask for anything, and that would even include asking for salvation, desiring salvation. If you could ever get to the point where needs would stop, where the fire of desire were quenched, as they say, that's one way of relating to reality. Now, I'm hesitating here because these things are not easy. These are not easy things to work out. But I think you might, if we had a lot of time to talk about this, you might be able to, you'd come to the point where we might be able to agree that Buddhism has some rather unique insights into the power of desire, or the influence of desire upon us, which are like the insights of Christianity into the necessity of the crucifixion. Now, I don't mean that the two are of equal weight, but but that's one thing one could learn from a Buddhist. I guess beyond that, there's a difference between relating to the world or to reality in a kind of analytical, discursive, kind of piece by piece approach, and relating to it intuitively, comprehensively, sort of grasping all of it at one time. And I think the Asian religions move more that second way than the Christian religion does, probably, although both possibilities are present in Christianity. I don't know. I think self-knowledge has increased in Buddhism, but through an awareness of Buddhism. But I think probably for the way it works out in practical terms is that through an exposure to the Buddhist religion, there's a certain kind of attentiveness to Christian resources develops, which wouldn't have developed, which may not have developed if we're simply left to those resources as we interpret them to ourselves. That is, there would be another kind of insight, because it's from another perspective on the meaning of the faith, the meaning of our faith, that we may not be able to acquire because of our the limitations of our location. But gee, I'm straining on these things because I've gone to these that kind of discussion is just yes.
Is a burning stick at both ends. For instance, if you have no desire, the little child is taught desire nothing. So these people grow up with the idea they're always fighting the sense of desire, so they desire nothing. So they get nowhere. But Jesus said to us, "Go and seek." Mm-hmm. And that idea of going seeking, we're knocking at the door constantly. Not just in faith, but we have carried that thing into our material world. Mm-hmm. So we go out with the power, and that power has reached into various avenues of life. We gave it even to our medicine, so we conquer the things about us. Mm-hmm. We desire to even conquer everything around us. Knock and it should be open out here. Mm-hmm. We're knocking at the door of all the medicine, all these diseases we have. And this is a sense of desire. We desire to conquer this, which is the very antithesis of Buddhism. See, so they're burning the stick at one end, both ends. Mm-hmm. Where they're, to me, as I have seen these people, they have quenched themselves. They have a holy desire. I have the same sense that I know several people. Mm-hmm. The feeling of a grand idea and a grand person, but at the same time, getting nowhere materialistically.
And I think if you just look at the way children are raised. I'll talk about my own children if I have to. just all these unmet desires all day long. The candy, just material things that they just have to have. And you know, does it ever lead to satisfaction? There's sort of an assumption that the next one will bring satisfaction. If you can, I know how it is economically. You see, if you can hit a certain level economically, then you ought to be happy. Gee, how could, my brother and I had a talk about that one time in Scotland. What would it take, we said, we asked each other, what would it take, how much money would you have to have each year to be able to forget about that so you wouldn't keep kind of questing for more or thinking about it? Well, we set on a certain sum about 10 years ago. We thought if he had 17,500, that would probably do it. But have you ever found anybody really who has enough? You know, if you start playing that game, you think a little bit more will do it, a little bit more. Well, see, the Buddhist says, the Buddhist, here I was going to talk about Thomas Merton tonight, not about the Buddhist, but I'll talk about Buddhism. He says that the only way you can ever resolve that is to quench it. Because you can't satisfy it. Desires will never be satisfied. And what desire does is to create false worlds. It creates worlds which are there to kind of minister to your lack of happiness, but they don't make you happy. The acquisition of things does not make one happy. And the only way to meet it head on is to root it out. See, to abandon desire. To get to the point where you don't desire anything. Because, gee, we talked about that today walking up to the mountain. Well, one of the things that's nice about this place is you don't have a car. I mean, you don't need a car. Now, and it's probably a good thing to have a car, but, you know, most people have two cars. Then you've got to service those cars, and you end up having all of these things that have to be serviced, and one's life becomes just a kind of a heavy round of implementing all the things that we have, which somehow we think will make us happy. But we all know, I mean, if you know that as soon as somebody dies, that isn't happiness. I mean, we all say that the happiness comes from the kind of simple things, the elemental things, like the bread on the table, a good conversation with somebody, health, all kinds of things that are given. You know, are given to us, which are not the products of our desire. I think that's the point that they want to do. It's elemental. You've returned to the elemental side of life, to those things which are most basic to the human spirit, and that's where happiness can be found. But the other stuff is fabricated.
Sounds like the Sermon on the Mount.
Well, that'd be a good place to end, I think.